Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Quad Cities NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and today my guest is the author of a very timely book that covers the career of Richard M. Daley, the longest-serving mayor in Chicago history. Now, I know you're wondering, why would we in the Quad Cities region be interested in a book about the former mayor of Chicago? I'll tell you why. Mayor Daley was a very effective manager who made government work better in a variety of areas, from public schools to parks to housing to policing. We live in a time when public confidence in all our institutions, and especially government, has declined rapidly. It's good to know that leaders can make government work better and make it more efficient. This is important for our democracy. And so the author of this book is with us today, and he had a major role in working with Mayor Daley to make government work better. He's Forrest Claypool, and the title of the book is called The Daley Show, Inside the Transformative Reign of Chicago's Richard M. Daley. I highly recommend this book. And Forrest, who's from downstate Illinois originally, is going to talk a little bit about the book today. Thank you so much for taking the time.
No, thanks for having me, Robin.
So, Mayor Daley was in six terms, and he's been out of office for about 10 years now. Why now did you decide to embark on writing a book about his tenure?
Yeah, kind of for the reasons you sort of talked about in your opening. Those of us who live in Chicago or the Chicago area have been, a lot of us have been upset about what's really happened since he left office, particularly in the last 10 years. He left office almost 13 years ago, but particularly in the last 10 or so, Chicago has kind of rapidly declined. We see endemic crime again. We see, you know, vestiges of disorder, homeless encampments, graffiti, abandoned buildings, rats. You know, we see the public schools are in turmoil again with the, you know, and families are leaving in droves. Businesses are leaving the city with their jobs and opportunities. And it's something that I felt that people needed to be reminded of what good municipal governance is, and also to be reminded of what the city of Chicago was like in 1989 when Mayor Daley took office, far worse even than the conditions today, and how he turned that around and made an international city over nearly a quarter century. But I felt there were lessons there that needed to be reminded. My high school history teacher said the only thing we learn from history is that we don't learn from history. And yet I feel like we need to, in order to try to improve our, as you point out, improve our governments, improve our democracy. And for those of us who believe in cities as engines of human progress, I think that's particularly important.
There was a time I remember reading where people felt cities were ungovernable in the 80s, and that turned around a lot in the 90s. But so you're a downstate boy. How did you end up in such a key roles with Mayor Daley? We'll talk about your specific roles in a bit, but give us a sense of the journey that led you to Chicago.
Yeah, I grew up in deep southern Illinois, closer to Kentucky than Chicago. But I went to law school at the university. I went to school at Southern and then Illinois Law School in Champaign-Urbana. And then my first big trip to the city was interviewing for law firms in Chicago. Got a job with a firm called Jenner and Block, practiced a little bit. But my interest and passion was in politics, always had been since I was a little kid. And so I started volunteering for campaigns, you know, Pat Quinn. And, I ended up at Paul Simon as his press secretary. He was a Southern Illinois downstate congressman who became senator, and I worked in his campaign as his press secretary. And I just sort of, worked my way up the political ladder. But I met a guy named David Axelrod in that campaign, the Simon campaign, and we worked closely together. Paul upset a three-term incumbent in a very Republican year, and we formed a political consulting company, an advertising company after that election. But again, that wasn't what I wanted to do for a career. You know, David, as everyone knows, went on to have a brilliant career that included electing, you know, Barack Obama president as a senior leader and advisor and strategist. But I really wanted to be in government. I really wanted to, you know, try to see how government could affect and make people's lives better. And one of our clients was Richard M. Daley when he was considering a run for mayor. And I got to know him closely, worked with him closely, began to trust my judgment, invited me into the administration as his chief of staff. And that's sort of how I got into that role and got sort of ensconced in Chicago government.
That's interesting because there's the image of his dad, Richard J. Daley, and then there's Richard M. Daley, who was different in important ways. And you talk about that in the book in several different areas. Can you talk a little bit about those? That maybe it surprised you, it went kind of against the caricature, maybe what you were expecting?
Sure, in a couple of ways. One is that Richard J. Daley was the consummate insider. He worked his way up the machine. He was a consummate state legislator, bureaucrat, party chair, and his son was poised to do the same thing. He took his father's former seat in the legislature. He took orders from the machine in Chicago, and then his life got turned upside down when his father suddenly died. And his appointed successor was defeated by an insurgent named Jane Byrne, and who immediately sought to eliminate any sort of support for the son Daley, because she feared a restoration of King Richard II. So she began firing all of his allies and payrollers, and he was literally alone. Kind of ironic that the son of the king was cast into the wilderness and had to reinvent himself in order first to survive, and then to lead an assault on the castle that his father built to claim power for himself. And so ironically, he ended up becoming allies with liberal allies in Springfield and reformers, anti-machine reformers, and passed nursing home reform, mental health reform, repealed the sales tax on food and medicine, and built a whole new sort of image for himself and new alliances for himself, and then led an unlikely insurgency against the very machine that his father built to win for Cook County State's Attorney in a big upset in 1980. And that became the platform for his later run for mayor, although he lost one in between. But so that was kind of interesting. The inside-outside thing was kind of a very ironic. The other irony was, is everyone remembers his dad as being very socially conservative. You know, he went to mass every day, had a religious ethnic base, and everyone thought Rich Daley was the same way. And he you know, was in many ways. But early on, he embraced gay rights. He embraced, you know, abortion rights. He embraced a lot of these liberal causes that caused people to sit up and who had become accustomed to his dad. And so it was kind of interesting. He kind of built his own. He learned from his father, but he built his own path forward.
And he also wanted to take an aggressive role on healing some of the racial problems that Chicago had.
Yeah, and that was his main focus. And he ran a campaign of racial reconciliation in 1989. The city had been roiled by a decade of racial maelstroms, council wars between African American and white aldermen. There was a white resistance led by Alderman Ed Verdoliak to the city's first black mayor, Harold Washington, and people wanted a uniter, not a divider. And so he spent much of his time trying to heal the city's racial divides and did an extraordinary job. He won a bare majority of the election first time, but in his last three terms, he won three out of every four votes in a city that's roughly divided, one-third white, one-third Latino, one-third African-American, kind of giving a sense of how he had appealed to all racial and ethnic groups.
So you're his first chief of staff, and you get to work closely with him, embarking on some of these major challenges that cities faced. And I'm not going to go back and talk about how Chicago was. You covered it briefly there a little bit, but they faced some serious challenges. How did you go about some of the initial reforms that Mayor Daley undertook and trying to change bureaucracy, which is, in a city the size of Chicago had to have been formidable?
For sure. And he started out incrementally. And the first thing he did long before he was able to tackle the big challenges, like tearing down the public housing high rises, which were cancer on the city, expanding O'Hare Airport, building Millennium Park, turning around a very troubled public school system, before he could even touch those complex, difficult tasks, he felt like that the city, the quality of life in the city had to be elevated, and he wanted to impose a sense of order because, as I said before, the city was, you know, in decline, and there were visible evidence of that decline everywhere. And so I have a chapter in the book called Quality of Life. I almost called it housekeeping because his first 2 years were essentially housekeeping to show that we could deliver services better. And one symbol of that was abandoned automobiles. And believe it or not, in 1989, the number one citizen complaint was abandoned automobiles. There were tens of thousands of junkers literally littering the city. And as you can imagine, most of those were in distressed areas. So it was this very, very powerful symbol of neglect and decay, and also sent a message to the residents of those areas that we don't really care. So his first goal was, I'm going to impose a sense of order and cleanliness. We're going to tow the abandoned cars. We're going to move homeless into shelters. We're going to eradicate graffiti. We're going to kill rats. And in his 20 years, he reduced the rat population 90%. He was relentless and ruthless in his anti-rat crusade. He tore down abandoned buildings. He fenced them and cleaned them. You know, his whole focus was cleanliness, planting flowers and trees. And so people had a sense of like, oh my goodness, this is an area that's safe. There's order. It's appealing. We can invest here. We can build a family here. So he did all that first before he did any of the more complex things.
Yeah, and I enjoyed reading how he would drive around the city and just see things he didn't like and put this major focus on quality of life issues, which I think, yeah, as you say, it provides a foundation for people feeling better about government can actually make a difference in their lives.
Exactly, that's exactly right. And he wanted to create that environment, and he did. I mean, he was known as the Green Mayor. He constantly wanted to find ways to beautify the city, and his sense of cleanliness was almost obsessive.
he undertook some controversial policies too. I remember in my work in the 1990s, he was rewarded, recognized for innovation in city management. And you carried out some of these policies when you worked for the Chicago Park District on outsourcing services, which usually is a bad four letter word for municipal unions, but that was played an important role.
It really did, both in improving service and in lowering cost. I mean, the way we solved the car towing problem was with a private partnership. It was a company that had a national fleet of sophisticated trucks that for insurance companies, doing towing for insurance companies. And they came in and they said, look, we'll give you $25 for every car we tow. In other words, you're not going to pay us $25 for every car we tow. We're going to give you $25 because they wanted to, so they could get the spare parts out of the cars. And it turned into a hugely successful public-private partnership that solved the problem. That was just one of many, many examples.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is Forrest Claypool, who's the author of a very important book I highly recommend to our listeners here with the holidays coming up. It's called The Daily Show, Inside the Transformative Reign of Chicago's Richard M. Daley. Not only a great book for those interested in public service, but also just on government and making government work better. There's a lot of great stories in here that Forrest tells on, again, the importance of making government work better for our democracy. And I think right now it's a very, very timely topic. We've been talking a little bit about Forrest's roots in downstate Illinois, how he came to work for Mayor Daley and when the mayor took over and some of his efforts to reform government. One very interesting thing that I thought is again relevant to people all over the Midwest really is how Chicago's economy changed from a heavy manufacturing reliance to services. And this was really critical because I remember when I would visit Chicago, the changes that took place, and it's when Chicago became really an economic powerhouse again.
Yeah, the city was, you know, Chicago was the hog butcher to the world, the manufacturing center, but it became a victim like many cities in the Rust Belt. And so when Daley took office, there were abandoned warehouses and abandoned factories everywhere. And like I said before, companies were leaving in droves. So he reinvented the city into a services and tourism economy and built a massive theater district downtown, for example, which was hugely successful. Millennium Park, of course, is a gigantic tourist draw. And the focus on services by building by elevating the quality of life, he was able to attract sort of the knowledge-minded you know, worker of the world global economy into the city of Chicago, and all those things can, you know, turn Chicago around.
No, he had many successes. We've talked about a lot of them, and people see them as tourists going up. But there were also some more of warts and all, is the way it's put, that you explore here. What happened on some of those? It seems to me, almost reading this, perhaps some hubris took over, where he was in longer. And is that a fair assumption to make, that he felt like he could get away with more later on? Or was it something else that led to some of the more egregious errors he made as a leader?
Yeah, for sure. And some lessons of government, some lessons of politics are timeless. One of them is, you heard often, you know, is Lord Acton's maxim that power tends to corrupt and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And it's no surprise that Daley's big scandals came when he was riding the highest, when he was at the peak of his popularity and power, and he had a sense that he could do no wrong and that he really didn't need pesky advisors, you know, telling him what to do or giving him contrary views. And as a result, he let these programs get out of control that were designed to increase his political power, a hired truck program that became a feeding trough for the mob and for corrupt city employees, a hiring program where his operatives were basically controlling every job in contravention of federal statutes, to unqualified people. Brought in, you know, the irony is that Daley, the former prosecutor, had to hire a white collar criminal defense attorney to represent him as the FBI questioned him in his fifth floor office about this corruption that oozed from every crevice of his government. And it was two huge scandals in contracting and patronage. And it was, you know, like I said, it was humbling for him, and probably very appropriately so. And the voters understood his sort of long sincerity. They understood that he wasn't personally financially profiting from the scandals. That was essentially mismanagement. And because of the previous 14, 15 years of success, they gave him a pass, and he got elected to another term and was able to kind of finish his transformation of the city.
It's obvious in reading this, too, that in order to make reform work, it's not just a short-term thing. There's not like an expiration date. You've got to keep at it. And your book, kind of, especially with the schools, goes through the ups and downs. And then after Daley left and you haven't been involved, it does seem like things fall apart. Good government's not a given. It takes constant leadership, right?
Yeah, leadership is the single most important thing, and voters really need to keep that in mind. Chicago voters, for whatever reason, the last two mayors they elected had zero management experience and extremely thin political resumes. They really were not equipped to handle one of the toughest jobs in the United States, and the results show. And then there's also been a creeping progressive sort of left lurch in the city that is where ideology kind of trumps sort of responsible governance or practical governance. And, you know, that's manifested in many ways, too, including takeover of the schools by a radical union, Chicago Teachers Union, which is, you know, years ago was taken over by a leftist wing. And so there's a combination of things there that have hurt the city. And again, it gets back to the fundamentals: elect strong, experienced leaders who are practical and not ideological. And the second piece is that are focused on the quality of life and also growth. I mean, you can't pay for the things that cities need to grow without business success. And if you're at war with the business, you know, you don't create the type of economy that allows for cities to flourish.
I've got to ask you, and you ran for county board and won. You beat the machine, which is a very interesting story as part of this book. But you're a Democrat, and I hear you talking about challenging the teachers unions and using outsourcing to make government work and an efficient government. That seems totally foreign to today's Democratic Party. What happened? I mean, and I guess my personal feeling is that the Democrats are the party that depend on making government work, and they've gotten away from this. Are there leaders out there that, how important do you feel that is to the overall Democratic message? And are there leaders out there carrying forth that?
Yeah, I think that's fundamental. I think this last election, I think, was a punch in the nose for Democrats and a wake-up call that we've gotten away from our roots and gotten into identity politics and leftist ideology, and it's harmed the city. We're not the party that I grew up with. But I think there's hope. I mean, when you lose like this, it does kind of allow for new growth in the underbrush and after the fire. I think to your point, getting results, showing government can work is what Democrats should be about. So I hope next time that we nominate a governor, because it's the governors out there, and we have a whole talented bench of governors out there who, not everywhere, but in some city, some states, seem to be really, you know, making their states work and have the support and popularity of the people behind them. And so I wouldn't be surprised to see if the Democrats nominate a governor next time that's got a record, you know, of success, and try to moderate their positions and get back to the fundamentals.
I'm not sure, and I'm not just saying this, but I'm not sure I've seen a resume as sparkling as yours as far as experience in government agencies. Here, just for our listeners, Forrest was chief of staff to Mayor Daley twice, superintendent of the Chicago Park District, president of the Chicago Transit Authority. You were chief of staff to Mayor Emanuel, who succeeded Mayor Daley. You're CEO of the Chicago Public Schools. That's just about all. You were everything except police chief, really. And you've talked about some of the key fundamentals, but I mean, for people out there serving in government or just interested in good government, what are some more of the principles that should be followed in making government work for people and just taking care of basic needs?
Well, part of it is listening. And our last two mayors here, and I think our leaders nationally, have done a very poor job of listening. Mayor Daley would every Saturday go out into the neighborhoods and meet with residents, meet with leaders of the community, sit down for breakfast and lunch and listen and take copious notes with an aide. And then they would follow up and follow through. And he had a sense of the neighborhoods, worked with them, built community policing and block clubs and all these things that had a two-way street of communication with residents. And if you understand where people are coming from, what their fears, what their needs are, you have a much better chance of success. I think at the federal level, we just saw in the last election how out of touch and aloof the elites are that dominate the Democratic Party today. And in Chicago under Daley, that just wasn't the case. And then some of the subsequent mayors fell into that same national trap, whereas he understood the neighborhoods intimately, where real people lived every day and what their needs were, and tried to maintain that connection. And that was everything.
See, as a person, I mean, you got to spend a lot of time with him, alone with him as chief of staff, also in the campaign. You worked as a press aide for him. How was he as a person? Take us behind closed doors. Was he a good guy, able to talk about baseball standings or whatever? Or was he just totally focused on the city, on work?
He tended to be focused on work, and he could be, on one hand, charming, and on the other hand, very sometimes unfairly critical or demanding. So it was a back and forth. But I mean, but when you work for him over a period of time, you realize that you kind of, you know, that he was under enormous pressure. I mean, the pressure that a big city mayor is under is unlike almost anything that people can imagine. And so that kind of sometimes would, you know, the pressure would sometimes build and the staff would take the brunt of it. But for the most part, the arc was of someone that, you know, everybody appreciated how successful he was and the vision he had and how much he cared deeply about the city. And also how he would give you room to run with the football as long as you were making progress. He wasn't a micromanager. He tried to recruit great people and say, here's my vision. Here's what I want you to get done. Now go do it. And that's critical, because when you have a leader like that who has the vision, the power, and also gives authority to people to let them do their jobs, you're going to attract a lot of very talented people and people that are willing to sacrifice money and prestige and other things to be part of that mission. And that's what he did. And that was a big part of his success. And it led to some of his big successes. I tell a couple of stories in the books about how things like, you know, the saving O'Hare Airport and the building of Millennium Park came down to the unique talents of one person, one individual who changed history. But they were only there because they were attracted to be part of what Mayor Daley was trying to build.
I got to ask you, you decided to run for office, which I had forgotten about. I do remember that back when it happened. But what possessed you to change from working inside government to then being an elected official? And it was kind of a painful story to some degree, and regarding your relationship with Mayor Daley.
Yeah, I didn't necessarily intend to run for public office. That wasn't something I'd planned on, but I was angry about what was going on in the county and county government, which was really an extension of the Daily Empire. And I talk about that in the book. One of the chapters is called Empire's Edge, because the county government, the patronage there, the contracts were part of Daly's empire and his allies there. But it was a cesspool. And, I wanted to do something about it. And I noticed when they redistricted that they had this sort of machine hack who was sort of the personification of everything that I hated about government was now representing me. And I thought, well, you know, I have a chance to do something about it and not just stew. And so I ended up running against this guy, and he had Daly support. He had the United Democratic machine behind him. And I talk about the campaign in the book. It's called, it tells a story of Chicago politics that no longer exists, back when ward politics was dominant, and you had all these colorful ward bosses who had tribal power and colorful captains, that were ringing doorbells, like John Quarters Boyle, who got his nickname from having pilfered $4 million in quarters from the tollway when he was running an armored car company. So lots of colorful characters. But Daly had promised me his neutrality. And when I got in, then his brother twisted his arm, who was at the county, and he unendorsed me and endorsed the other guy. So the chapter of the book is called Betrayal. And as you point out, I ended up running against the machine and barely winning in a kind of a fascinating campaign. But that was why I ran. I was angry about what was going on at this county. I felt like I can do something about this. And the guy that I was running against, conveniently was the personification of everything I hated about government, everything that gave government, discredited government, and made it hurt the very people who depended on it. In the case of the county, that was people without health insurance and kids who were juveniles who were subject to the state and who were routinely being sexually abused at the juvenile center.
That's a great chapter. I just have time for one more question here. I got about a minute. I got to ask this because it took me a long time, but I finally read this summer the classic book, The Power Broker, by Robert Shirk, about Robert Moses. This is the 50th anniversary. Did you read that? And I remember the reason I thought of you was because he started in parks, of all places, his career in running parks. Had you read that book before you started your career in government? Did it have any impact?
I read it a long time ago, but I can't even remember how long ago. It was so long ago. And I go back to it repeatedly because it is a remarkable book. And of course, it's not for the faint of heart, as you know, and you should be congratulated because it's 1,050 pages. But it is a classic. It was a Pulitzer Prize winner. And anybody who really cares about and wants to learn about government at its core, it is probably the most brilliant book ever written. He's also the author, of course, of these four LBJ books, which are very, very popular. But yeah, no, I'm glad you read that. And it's something that book, it's a serious government aficionados and political aficionados. It's a must read.
It's a must read. And for people around here, your book is as well. My guest today on Heartland Politics has been Forrest Claypool, the author of The Daily Show, Inside the Transformative Reign of Chicago's Richard M. Daly. Great holiday gift. If you're looking for us, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thanks, Rob. Really appreciate you having me. It was fun.
You've been listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at wvik.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.